We'll now call upon our brother Frank to lead us in our fourth session of the day entitled Gog of the Land of Magog. What has happened to Russia? Brother Frank.
This puts us on page 8 of our notes, brothers and sisters, and we're going to have to... Am I on? Well, I'm going to have to concentrate on this because I don't have a lot of overheads. The things I really want to talk about are quite recent events that are taking place in Russia. And just try to make sure that with the events that have transpired and some of the ideas that we expected not coming to pass, that we haven't lost hope in this area. We haven't crumbled under this. Because I don't know of anybody, certainly no one that I was familiar with, either in reading or in speaking to, ever expected what happened in 1991 with the demise of the Soviet Union. That was just unexpected. And I remember participating in many, many lectures where we felt that it was the atheistic, communistic aspect of the Russians that would bring them down. I remember speaking that myself, and it hasn't turned out that way. We don't know what might yet transpire in Russia, but there are some very exciting things that are occurring that given us reason to believe that there are things we have missed on the way. Most important thing, however, if we open Ezekiel 38 and 39, because those are the two chapters we're going to work on, is that we have a peg in this chapter that tells us where we are and where it's going to. These are the critical things. They're the road signs prophetically that prove that we are on track. Our problem with Ezekiel 38 is understanding some of the details. But verse 8 says, after many days, thou shalt be visited. In the latter years, thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword, is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. Now that has been the link. That's the verse. That's the link which brethren worked on in the last 50 years, because they could see that with the people of Israel going back to the land, it was now the time, as we showed that overhead, that all nations would be gathered down into the land of Israel. And this prophecy, being about a group of nations, could not occur until this verse 8. The land is brought back from the sword, gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel. It could hardly be clearer. It's no wonder that brethren spoke very largely on this. I mean, the campaigns have been held around the world where there'd been audiences of well over 1,000 in some of the town hall efforts, where that was the subject. And brethren were prepared to, you know, offer this to as many people as could possibly read it and deal with it. There was a couple of variations, probably weren't all that helpful. You may remember a little leaflet that went out that was said that God will bury Russia in Israel. Now, taking liberty with language, I guess you can understand that. But there's something about that subject which was misleading. And the facts were that that would imply that Russia would be dealt with in one foul swoop. When Russia came down into Egypt, that would be it all over for Russia. And that was not proven in the publication. It wasn't even an attempt to prove that. It would be like saying that United States' 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean is destroyed and gone, therefore United States is no more. If you destroy an army, you don't necessarily destroy the country, unless you've gone about to prove it. How that in destroying an army that's in the Middle East, you've also destroyed the nation. And I don't know that was proven. In fact, I'm quite sure it was not proven. So the most you could say is that God would destroy a Russian-led army in the Middle East. And that would have been more to the point. However, going back to verse 8 of Ezekiel 38, the thing fits very, very well. It was obviously a prophecy of Ezekiel that occurred some 2,500 years ago, but it did say, verse 8, after many days. It was a land brought back from the sword, characteristic of the country, gathered out of many people, characteristic of the way the Jews have come back, against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, characteristic of what we see, but it's brought forth out of the nations. You could hardly get a better fit for what we have seen in the past. So we don't abandon that because, well, something's happened in Russia that has turned the country around, and it's not the great menace it once seemed to be, at least that's the way it appears. We don't just throw that argument out altogether, because it illustrates, as we read down through the verses, that this will lead to the coming of the Lord. And that's what we'd like to illustrate from the text. First of all, if we read later in Ezekiel 38 itself, it illustrates that when this nation and group of nations come down, it tells us about the great earthquake that will take place, verses 19 and 20. It tells about God judging him in a way that will be obvious and just vindicating his name, showing himself to be separate from all other gods and powers in the world. And the end will be that, verse 23, he would be known in the eyes of many nations. Now, the prophecy is really doubled, and I think we know the significance of when God doubles something. It's like the dreams that he gave to Pharaoh, which Joseph interpreted. It was doubled. And it's not unusual for God to do that. So Ezekiel 39 starts off the same way, to prophesy against Gog. I'm against thee, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. It's the same lead-in. That's not unusual for God to do that. But to miss that point and to put that some other time in history is to make quite a difference on all the details. I believe that we are talking about the same thing. So that in verse 8 of chapter 39, it is come, it is done, saith the Lord God. This is the day where I have spoken, is an amplification of Ezekiel 16, or sorry, Revelation 16, where the same words are heard at the end of the sixth vial and in the introduction of the seventh vial. Now, I've also wanted to point out the verses 22 and 29. 22 says, so the house of Israel shall know that I am Yahweh, their God, from that day and forward. See, we're seeing something that no other time in history could possibly fulfill, because that's not true of the Jews. So it remains to be fulfilled. Verse 29, neither will I hide my face anymore from them, for I have poured out my spirit upon the house of Israel, saith the Lord Yahweh. So that hasn't happened yet. So this prophecy, which we can see from Ezekiel 38, verse 8, that the groundwork is set for it because Israel's back in the land. And as Joel 3 said, now it's a matter of gathering all nations. This is the detail or further detail of what will lead right up to the coming of the Lord and the establishment of the kingdom. Now, we expected, as I mentioned in this fifth point on page 8, we expected it would be the atheistic communists. And I can remember the writings, the more recent writings, not the writings of John Thomas, but the more recent writings where people thought it was the atheistic aspect to it. It was the godlessness of those people that was the characteristic that God was working on to bring them into the Middle East. But there was very little written, as I mentioned earlier, on what it meant when it said, I will turn thee back, put hooks into thy jaws, and will bring thee forth. Now, I think it's important to recognize, and if you've done a little study in this, you will see this. In Ezekiel 39, verse 2, it suggests that there would be something left. I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee, and will cause thee to come on from the north parts, and will bring thee upon the mountains of Israel. Now, in other translations and working through the same text, there is no suggestion there would be any of them left. It's an awkwardness that even the margin of the King James Version recognizes and gives an alternative to. What God is suggesting, I think, in this prophecy to our minds is what he's saying in chapter 38, verse 4. He's going to turn them back, going to put hooks into their jaws, and will bring thee forth. What's it mean? Now, I'm not going to tell you what it means either, because I don't know what it means. But I think we need to look for what that means. And even as Brother Pierce is suggesting, and others are suggesting, that with the warming up of the Russian people to the church, and the fact that in the elections, even the communists thought it was important to get the backing of the church, we see a big change in the organization and the leadership of the country, which once saw their strength to be to blow up the churches and abandon that kind of worship in Russia, now see, hey, the way to control people and to really keep them with you and to make them loyal to you is to let the church grow and just make sure you've got control of it. So it's not as if it was totally independent, but it is definitely back to the church. And this is just having all kinds of interesting things going on at the same time. I believe it is possible. You know, it's just one of the things that appears to be possible from the way things are going and happening at the present day. It may not be at all. But when it says that God would turn them back, you wonder whether or not this loss of fortune, this loss of power that occurred in 1991 when the Soviet Union broke up is what God meant when he said, I'll turn you back. Because the nation was really provocative. And many nations were setting their agenda according to what that nation was doing. We do know it's great power in Eastern Europe. We do know that where it stretched out to reach into the Middle East and to control in Egypt and the influence it had in the wars that were in the Middle East, it was a power to be reckoned with, a great power. But it came to next to nothing. And much of the power there is there in a sense, but without strong leadership, it wouldn't be a factor in the world. So now we see something new developing. And I wonder if maybe we can start to see some of the reasons why God says, I'll put hooks into your jaws. Jerusalem is to be the burdensome stone. It's to be the stone where all the nations come together because of Jerusalem. Now, what interest have they got in Jerusalem except religious interests? And why is it that the Russian people seem to be supporting the Palestinian cause, except that they have a similar cause? They have a lot of real estate in Israel too, and especially in Jerusalem, that they would like to lay claim to. So they have a commonness in that cause. And I suggest that it would be at least worth thinking in terms of the events that will obviously take place in the future about that interest, about how God, like other nations, is drawing them into the Middle East because Jerusalem is the stone which all nations are going to be burdened over and which is going to hurt them badly when they get involved with it. And of course, that's not unrelated to Zionism. The controversy of Zionism, which is mentioned in the scriptures, the whole idea of Israel in the land is really what's causing the problem for these nations. Now, Brother Pierce says something in here, and I just find this astonishing. I only got this book on Thursday. And I only read it on the airplane on the way down, so it is pretty new. But nevertheless, I really do think it's worth considering. He has a section in here, development of the dragon, and he talks about it under the heading the Romanovs. This is not familiar territory for me. But there are some brethren who are really quite good at this, who have spent a lot of time in studying Europe and know the significance of even the family names in Europe. But let me read what it says, and you can make of it whatever you like. He says the Romanov family have been czars since 1613. Bearing in mind that Gog is the land of Magog, Germany, it is exciting to discover that they are a German family. He quotes this, gets this out of a book. Oh, it's Encyclopedia Britannica. Interesting. He says, the Romanovs were not of Rurik stock, the line of the previous czars, nor were they even of very ancient lineage. They descended from a German nobleman who had emigrated to Moscow early in the 14th century. His fifth son, named Koska, the cat, became head of the family of the Koshkins, many of whom were prominent at the court of Moscow in the 14th, 15th centuries. Early in the 16th century, one of them, whose first name was Roman, called himself Romanov. His daughter, Anastasia, was Ivan the Terrible's first wife. Now, you know this? It was her son, Theodore, who was the last czar of the Rurik dynasty. So it's in the Encyclopedia Britannica how this all came about. And the interesting thing is that Yeltsin is trying to reestablish the czars. Now, I've wondered for a long time as to whether this man would ever survive. I guess all of us have. Like, he's been so weak, and, you know, you just think it, he's gone, and even Time magazine and the news media have given what the likely successor is going to be and what his characteristics are. And Zhirinovsky, well, you know, everyone thought he was going to be the person. We read his book and all those ideas about coming down in the Middle East. Why is Yeltsin still in office? And I read this, I thought, well, this could be interesting. And I guess even our brother Pierce just managed to squeeze this in because it happened in December, and he's writing about 1996, so he didn't have much time. He says, in the last day of 1996, the Daily Telegraph carried two thrilling headlines. The dragon really was coming alive. The headlines were, Yeltsin welcomes back heir to the Tsar, and Romanovs to revive the Russian dream, Yeltsin sees his future in the czars, which you may get the pun there. The heir apparent to the last czar is to be reinstated as the head of Russia's imperial family by President Yeltsin in Moscow early next year, a Kremlin source said today. Grand Duke Grigory Mikhailovich Romanov, 15, is to return to Russia with his mother, Great Duchess Maria Vladimirnov, or something like that, and grandmother, Great Duchess Leonida Georgievna, not a Russian, who live in Madrid. Although the Kremlin has kept the move secret, the senior source confirmed that Mr. Yeltsin had signed a decree that will officially reinstate the family, which has been living in exile since 1918 when the Bolsheviks massacred the last Tsar, Nicholas II, and his family. And that's where the Spain connections comes from, of where he's been living. Now, what does all that mean? Well, first of all, we don't know what the answer is to God putting hooks in the jaws of Russia and leading them on. But we are interested in that Russia now is turning religious, something we never saw since 1917 in the revolution. What's interesting is, why is Yeltsin still in power? But one of his aims is to reestablish a czar. It's almost like having the British royal family. They're not really in command, but in a sense, they're a figurehead. If this young chap happens to be of German descent. Now, I don't know of anybody that had an answer, a good answer, for what it meant, Gog of the land of Magog. That's the nearest inclination to an interpretation of that I've heard. That it's possible that a figurehead or a leader in Russia really would be not a Russian, but come from Germany. And this young man, his descent is from German descent. I just leave it with you. We have no idea whether this will work out, but prophecy is exciting. And as we now are privy to things so quick through the media, for anybody that's bored, there's lots to be done. I don't know how you could be bored in this area of the world. I mean, there's so much to do, you must never be bored. But when you're living in a refrigerator for 6 months of the year, there's lots of time to think. and to try to do something to warm you up, and this at least gets you warm inside. Now, I think another thing that we need to look at, as people have not helped us by coming along with interpretations of what might happen in prophecy, which mixed people up. So they're not too sure now who Russia represents. There is a videotape out where, in terms of Ezekiel 38, as much as would be admitted that there's a Russian element in this, is that the Muslim part of the former Soviet Union, the republics in the south of the former Soviet Union, must be what this chapter is about. Now, could that be? Why does the prophet go to the point of saying he comes from the uttermost parts of the north? That's exactly what it says in chapter 39. He says that in other places too, but chapter 39, verse 2, I will turn thee back, leave but the sixth part of thee, will cause thee to come up from the north parts. The sides of the north is what the margin renders it, and will bring thee upon the mountains of Israel. Now, it would seem to me that there is no reason to change that aspect of what we've been thinking. It's Moscow, Tobolsk, and the area of Magog being the area of Germany, the area of Gomer being the area of France, Persia being roughly where Iran is, Ethiopia and Libya roughly where they are now. I don't know why we need to change any of that, because nothing significantly has happened. But isn't it interesting, as I say in the bottom of page 8 here, just to draw this to your attention, where's Egypt? Where's Jordan? Where's Syria mentioned in that chapter? If, in fact, we were looking for the Arab nations immediately around Israel and immediately around Jerusalem to be major players in this invasion, why are they not mentioned? Why does he go to the extent of mentioning Libya and Ethiopia, but he doesn't mention Syria? He doesn't mention Jordan. He doesn't mention those, or Egypt rather, those prominent nations, at least Egypt. Well, if you remember what our brethren have been telling us for many, many years in the exposition of Daniel chapter 11, it's because we're not on the same side. Have a look at Daniel chapter 11. Now, why would we say that Daniel chapter 11 is a chapter to be referenced in our context? Like, we have to be honest with ourselves on this. There has to be at least some reference that it's clearly our day, and some reference that it clearly goes on to the coming of the Lord. Well, the introduction of chapter 12 with the words "at that time" would imply that chapter 12 continues right on from chapter 11. The events are similar. And the last events of chapter 11 really start at verse 40, because it is introduced at the time of the end. So verses 40 to 45 of chapter 11 and the first few verses of chapter 12 seem to be talking about the same time. Well, clearly chapter 12 verse 2 is talking about the resurrection. Well, that's the coming of the Lord. There's no question about that. And if the same time in chapter 12, verse 1, is this time at the time of the end of verse 40, then we would expect there has to be the sequence of events from verse 40 that lead right on to the resurrection, the coming of the Lord. And that's where we get the whole idea of verse 1 of chapter 12, there would be a time of trouble such as never was. And that's our subject for tomorrow morning. But when you look at this king of the north, verse 40, that comes against the king of the south, like a whirlwind, verse 40, with chariots, horsemen, many ships, shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. There's some details here we need to remember. He enters into the glorious land. Many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his land, even Edom, Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Where's that? Jordan. It couldn't be anywhere else. It's been that way historically, that Edom, Moab, and Ammon represent the East Bank of the area of the land of Israel, and that is to escape his hand. So they're obviously not with the king of the north. They escape his onslaught. So people who have thought that this great onslaught was the Arab nations immediately around Israel in combination with Russia, either must not think Daniel 11 applies or they've just ignored the fact. But look what he goes on to say. It says in verse 42, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So Egypt isn't with them. But then Ezekiel 38 did not include Egypt. So you've got to see it different from what we have been looking at in the past, where in 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, Egypt was involved. Jordan was involved in those conflicts. But this conflict, they escape. They're not on the same side. They just happen to escape Edom, Moab, and Ammon escape. But he has power. He goes down and takes Egypt, and Egypt doesn't escape. So I think that helps clarify that what we have believed in literature, as long as I've been reading about what's going to happen, it have not deviated from that. There have been other ideas, but I don't see any reason to see that we need to change. The prophecy is quite clear, and there's nothing that I can see on the horizon or what's happened to illustrate that we've made a mistake in that area. Now, going over to page 9, what a tremendous vindication of Ezekiel 38, verse 13. You may have noticed in the writings of Brother Pierce and Milestones and Brother Billington in the Bible magazine, if you are aware of those publications and read them, that both of those sources, and they're essentially both British, although Brother Paul is Canadian, he lives in Canada, he is British and has a lot of connection with brethren in Britain, but they are convinced and have given a lot of evidence in their writings that this power Tarshish is Britain. Now, brothers and sisters, all I can say is if you're not convinced of that, you want to just at least look over the literature that says it to make sure that you've at least read the things that are in favor of that interpretation. If I can just find the booklet that I think supports this probably as good as any, it's this one. It's a Bible magazine. It's called Tarshish and the Young Lions Thereof. And I just think that Brother Billington did a very good job on that, and I don't know of anybody that's ever been able to produce anything other. Whoever answer what this verse is all about, chapter 13 of Ezekiel 38, other than look at history. Who's the lion? Where did that come from? And those are the kinds of things which God, I believe, provides, little kinds of things like that, to illustrate that we are on the right track. Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish. Well, where was Saudi Arabia in the other wars? Where were those Arab nations in that peninsula? How were they positioned with Israel? But now, they're not with this adversary. They are with the king of the south. They are with the merchants of Tarshish and the young lions thereof. So we don't see this alignment with the Arabs that we have seen in the 48, in the 67, 56, 67, 73 wars. It's a different alignment of nations. There may be an Islamic element to it, but however it finally works out, we see Jordan separated, we see Egypt separated, and we see Saudi Arabia separated, not with the northern nations that are coming down. And I think that's worth noting. I don't know how that will work out finally, because it would set Arabs against Arabs. But didn't God say that? That would be a characteristic of the people? So even in that, we're seeing what we would expect. By going down and invading Kuwait, we saw nations very quickly assembled together. And I don't know if you've analyzed that, but I thought it was rather incredible that Saddam did not recognize the initiative that he had. If he'd continued to go down the coast and not stop at Kuwait, he could really have held the world ransom by taking the oil fields in general. Yeah, they weren't well defended. and he could have moved down with the armies he had, moving very quickly and done roughly what he did in Kuwait, which would really have hurt the Western world, but somehow really stopped the Kuwait. I think you see the hand of God in these things. Like, he had a work to do, and I don't know what that work is, but isn't it interesting the man survives? With everything they've tried to do to bring him down, the man survives. Now, I think there's something about this that is significant. What does this man represent? I got so many overheads up here that I fortunately did not organize them just to deal with this, but I can put my fingers on this one. It goes back to the time when Saddam made his run down in the Middle East. And this is the one. This was priceless, I thought, anyway. I don't know if you can see this one. It came out of Time magazine. Can't get it much higher. It was February 25, 1991. It's a picture of Saddam Hussein with a tree, shaking hands with Nebuchadnezzar. Now, if you're a Bible student and you saw that picture, I tell you, that causes the adrenaline to flow. This man, in this article, saw himself as modern Nebuchadnezzar. And he was going to establish Babylon in the glory of the nations, just as Nebuchadnezzar. That's exactly his vision. I mean, he'd read history. He knew what Iraq represented to the world, that he wanted to recreate it. Well, read a little more about that in our next session, but he never was able to achieve it, but neither were they able to take him out. Now, haven't you heard brethren tell you, who have done a study on Daniel chapter 2, that in the latter days, the image must stand intact? And you wondered, how could you get the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, the Roman element all to stand together so that the little stone hits the whole image and the whole image comes down together? It's not destroyed in stages of history. But you got this chap who thinks he's Nebuchadnezzar, the head of the image, and he's still around. I mean, in a sense, God's brought it to our attention that the head is alive, whatever it might mean to you in any other way. There has to be some significance that he is in the area where Nebuchadnezzar ruled. It's alive. He wants to destroy the Jews, and he hasn't been destroyed himself. He's just been sort of held in abeyance. We know our Daniel chapter 2, that's got to be significant. You got the Iranians, who probably represent at least a lot of ancient Persia, still there in a very anti-Jewish position. We've got the Roman leg, we've talked about it, in the Roman Catholic Church, and whatever you might make of the brazen Greeks, we certainly have the Greek element rising in our day through the Greek Orthodox Church and through the other part of the former Roman Empire. I mean, there are incredible things happening. Prophecy. We talked about it as a theory. The image must stand, but you look around the world, you say the components are there. Something has got to unite them to do the work that's described. And Ezekiel 38, 39, I think, give us those details. I just want to make one more note. I did not refer to this on page 9 under point 7, the nations of the south will stand against Gog. Some of the things that Brother Billington brings to our attention about Britain, I think are really worth considering. I don't know that there is any publication that has them all together except that one. It's the only one that I know of where he put everything he could find about Britain being the Tarshish of the Bible, one publication. And I also know that Brother Pierce is adding all the time. Like, every time he produces milestones, there's a section in there about Britain. And if you want the details, you won't find it documented any better than these brothers are doing. They're doing an excellent job, not just giving you opinion, they tell you where they got it from. You can check it out. And that, to my mind, is basic to any research we're doing. So we have Britain, we have the United States. There was France involved in that particular standoff as well against Saudi Arabia.
And there was other of the Commonwealth nations involved. Certainly Saudi Arabia played a great part themselves. We've seen in just the other little flare-up that occurred recently against Saddam Hussein that France stood apart from it. And we would expect that. We don't expect France to be part of this. If they're Gomer, they're not Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish. So there has to be that sort of departure. And what he writes in this Milestones for 1996 is really quite interesting on that point as well. You're still on your chairs? I mean, it's exciting stuff, isn't it? Just amazing. So now on number 8, the earthquake link. And helping us to put the pieces together is just to see the significance of the earthquake that's reported in Ezekiel 38, Zechariah 14, Revelation 16, and Joel 3. They all talk about a great earthquake. The heavens and the earth shake, and Yahweh roars out of Zion. Or the great earthquake that's described in Revelation 16 and Zechariah 14, the splitting of the Mount of Olives. Ezekiel 38, every wall falls to the ground. You have to imagine, because how else could he do it? That if Peter says, as God overthrew or destroyed the nations at the time of Noah with a flood, and he did it so thoroughly that it took people a long time to find any civilization that existed at that time. They had to dig through all the various layers. I think it was Sir Leonard Woolley that in his archaeology in the Middle East explains how he didn't think there was anything because he got into this clay and there was nothing. He thought he got down before to the bottom civilization, but kept on digging and then found this civilization that was buried under tremendous thicknesses of clay, illustrating what the Bible said would be there, that there was a civilization destroyed by water. But Peter tells us that the heavens and the earth, which are now, will be destroyed likewise by fire. And if Sodom and Gomorrah are the way God's going to do that, just think of it. He talks about fire and brimstone being rained upon the people. Every wall falling to the ground with the earthquakes. That's what God tells us. It's going to be the end and the demise of present civilization. You just sort of wonder, I mean, Zechariah does tell us the nations which are left will come up to worship. Without Zechariah telling us that, you'd sort of wonder how many are going to be left. Because how many were left in the days of Sodom? Jesus says he destroyed them all. He says that in Noah's day it destroyed them all. He makes a point of that in Luke 17. Likewise shall it be in the day of the coming of the Son of Man. So all of the fortifications, all of the defenses that men have is useless compared to what God intends to do. And we're living on the threshold of it. It stirs you, brothers and sisters, but stirring us is not enough. What's it stir us to do? Going home stirred will last about a half hour. You can't maintain that feeling. And if you don't do something, don't plan to do something, it ends up like it does so many times, that nothing ever changes. We'll speak about that more a little later. Point 9, the purpose of the invasion. Ezekiel 38, verse 16. Thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the nations may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. It put hooks into their jaws, lead them on, and what God's going to do is reestablish his authority, his power in the world where people today live godless lives. Now, what I think is the parallel to help us understand what he means is Jeremiah 25. Just look at the words of this chapter. Now, we know what this primarily refers to because Jeremiah was referring to the time of Babylon coming against Israel and how the land would be destroyed. But why was God doing it and how is he doing it? Look what he says. For lo, I begin to bring evil on the city which is called by my name. Should you be utterly unpunished? You shall not be unpunished, for I will call for a sword upon all the inhabitants of the earth, says the Lord Yahweh of hosts. Therefore prophesy thou against them all these words, and say unto them, Yahweh shall roar from on high, that's the words of Joel, and utter his voice from his holy habitation. He shall mightily roar upon his habitation, and give a shout as they that tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth. A noise shall come even to the ends of the earth, for Yahweh hath a controversy with the nations. He will plead with all flesh. He will give them that are wicked to the sword, saith Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation. A great whirlwind shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth, and the slain of Yahweh shall be at that day from one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth. They shall not be lamented, nor gathered, nor buried. They shall be as dung upon the ground. God does things in proportion to his people, and we believe he does because Deuteronomy leads us to believe that. He does say in Zechariah that two-thirds of the people would be cut off in the land, and he would bring the third through the fire. If he applied the same proportions to the Gentiles, do you know how many people that would be in a world of about 6 billion people? That's a tremendous, tremendous destruction from one end of the earth to the other, which is what God implies. When he begins to bring evil upon the city called by his name, the judgment upon the nations is not far behind. And if two-thirds of the house of Israel are cut off and destroyed, well, just think what it means. Two-thirds of the nations of the world, 4 billion people cut off and destroyed. That's a tremendous destruction. You can't help but shiver a little when you think about it, when you're really thinking about it, what God says he will do. Now, one of the things which is helpful, you may remember when I mentioned that we had a title that said God would destroy Russia and Israel. I said, how do you do that when you destroy an army? We have a look at Daniel chapter 12. There may be more to this. I don't know whether the brethren who wrote that title or first thought it up had this in mind or not, but it is worth considering. Actually, it's not Daniel 12, it's Daniel 11, verse 45. It says of this power that comes against the land, the king of the north, that he would plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Now, we can well imagine that if an army came down, like we described, if the United States 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean was just totally destroyed, it would not destroy the United States. But if the whole seat of government was in the 6th Fleet when it was destroyed, it just could mean that. Because it would essentially mean that the government or the policies of the government were now up for grabs because there was no governors around and people would have to elect and choose new people. If it implies that he would plant the tabernacles of his palace, would mean that the leader, the governor of this king of the north, would actually establish authority in Jerusalem, then you can understand that in destroying that, you have destroyed the power. And that then, as God describes very clearly in Ezekiel 39, that he sends a fire upon Magog that quite upon the heels of the judgments in Jerusalem, that God goes forth to Europe, and there is this fire of destruction, which I think is what we find in Peter's description in 2 Peter 3, which will bring judgment upon those that he says dwell carelessly in the isles, and they will know that I am Yahweh. It's quite a picture. One of the things that was done by young people one time was tried to dramatize that. I don't know if you've heard young people put a play on where they tried to dramatize it through a news media, people announcing what's happening and You know, things are happening so quick, it's very hard to describe it. But I tell you, there is a side to this, which is hard to appreciate unless you just let this work on your imagination of what it's going to be like. It is going to happen. Society is going further and further away from God, which just means his judgments must be that much closer. This day is going to be reality. And I think we need to talk this up more as a community so that we might be more inward thinking and more inward looking. Little picture that Harry Tennant mentioned in one of his Bible schools stayed in my mind. He had a wonderful conception of what it is like sometimes in Christadelphia. You can imagine if this meeting was outside and all the events of going outside were all around us, there'd be a lot of people that'd be distracted. He says, you imagine Israel in some of the lower times of their history as being a city in the land of Israel, a city with a big fence around it. And the prophet went in to see the people of the land, and he got the temple right in the middle of the land. And he expected, you know, as the tabernacle was in the center and the people were positioned facing the tabernacle, that everyone would be looking at the tabernacle. But what in fact he found in many times in their history was everybody was at the fence looking the other way. That instead of people really starting to look at what fires us up, and is the spirit that works within us to get out there and get working, if we would look at that, if we would talk about it, if we'd make it central to our worship, then maybe there wouldn't be so many Christadelphians who in their life are looking the other way all the time. They have their backs to the truth. They're looking at what the glitter of the world is. And hence, we're powerless. What they could be doing with their time and their energy is not being used, it's wasted. Watching the world. Entertained by the world, using what God has given us for anything but to sound out the coming judgments of God upon this land and upon the world at large. And just finally, point 10, will there be nuclear war? Now, if Ezekiel 38 and 39 is describing the onslaught of these nations against Israel, which we believe has nuclear weapons, and the Soviet Union or the area of Russia and the nations up in that area besides Russia now that also have nuclear weapons, will they be used? Well, I can remember in the early 60s when we were doing campaigns, and it was the custom of a lot of people in those days to do them open air, not just in places like Allen Gardens, but to get a trailer and put some big 4x8 signs on there and a couple of loudspeakers to go out in the middle of town. And the pictures on these were bombers dropping bombs. You remember those days, the early 60s? Remember the standoff between President Kennedy and President Khrushchev? They were days when people went to work with their transistor radios. Boy, they didn't want to miss anything. The missile boats were on their way, and they thought this could be it. Their sides were testing these huge weapons, and you know, everybody was just sort of spooked. And of course, nothing happened. But people have never forgot that they almost went to war. And you know, the ideas of just some of the other alerts that people have had in other parts of the world, especially in the Middle East, when in 1973 it looked like Israel was going to get beaten back. We're very close, we would expect, to using them. Well, verse 3 of chapter 39 tells us that God will smite the bow out of thy left hand and cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. Now, like everything else in the text, it has to have some significance, and I don't make that to be anything other than disarming. It never says, and it gives us detail, quite a lot of detail of the cleanup in Ezekiel 39. It doesn't give us anything that I can see that speaks of the cleanup from nuclear war. But it does say that they will burn the weapons. And it does say that they will burn these weapons for a long time. Verse 9. That they that dwell in the cities of Israel will go forth and shall set on fire and burn the weapons, both the shields, the bucklers, the bows, the arrows, the hand staves, the spears. They shall burn them with fire 7 years. not burning the land or cleansing the land, but burning the weapons, destroying the weapons, because that's God's intention. They'll learn war no more. Not peace by armed to the teeth, but peace because they don't learn war anymore. It's not that essential fabric of the economy, which we find it in today's world. So I don't believe that there is the evidence of nuclear war in the text. I believe that God will be able to work ways in which we do not know. When it tells us in Ezekiel 38 that he would essentially cause panic to come upon the people. Chapter 38, verse 21. I'll call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord Yahweh. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. What's that mean? Except that we know in the Old Testament there were times when the nation stood against Israel. Israel didn't have to fight at all, because God did something where the nations just attacked each other and destroyed each other. So it's not really for us to try to reason through everything and explain how God will do it, except that the evidence that he gives implies he disarms the enemy, and that the weapons that were intended to destroy Israel are burned and destroyed by them for a period of 7 years. Exciting things, brothers and sisters, and all I can say is that this is going to keep our attention, I would think, for some time yet, seeing how these things develop. But there is no reason to believe that we are derailed, and that we're really on the wrong track. I think we're right on. We've just seen some things that have illustrated meaning to a section that we didn't work on very much about turning Russia back and putting the hooks in their jaws and leading them on. And we may be wrong even now on what we think that means. But the picture does appear to be getting clearer. And I think that's helpful and supportive.